Most microbial evolution experiments do not involve gene exchange. In fact, gene exchange typically is excluded from these experiments because it's a complication. This creates a situation where the degree of evolution that can occur in the laboratory can pale to a large degree to what you can see in the wild. Of course, in the wild, you have huge volumes, you have large amounts of time, you have great heterogeneity, but you also have this potential for seemingly good species that you would expect to not be exchanging genes between each other, to in fact be exchanging genes among microbial organisms. And as a consequence, microbes have a flexibility in their evolution that can be rather dramatic, particularly in comparison to the degree of flexibility that we're used to when thinking about, for example, the evolution of modern animals. So this chapter creates kind of a bookend to the previous chapter in completing the introduction to what microorganisms and microbial evolution is all about in talking about gene exchange. Okay, so gene exchange. So, talking about the ways in which bacteria specifically exchange genes, we've got transduction, which is mediated by bacteriophages. And in this case, the bacteriophages inadvertently package some of the bacterial DNA and then transfer it as though it were viral DNA to a recipient bacterium. We have conjugation, where we have plasmids that encode their own transfer from one bacterium to another bacterium. We have these HFR strains, which probably don't play that big a role in the wild, but perhaps occasionally do, where these transferable plasmids are able to integrate into the host chromosome, and thereby, when they transfer themselves, they end up transferring the host chromosome as well. So lots of bacterial genes can be transferred by this mechanism. And then we also have transformation, where DNA that has found its way into the extracellular environment is able to be taken up by cells and then integrated into the chromosome of the recipient cell. So all of this movement of DNA is unilateral, so it's going from some donor cell to some recipient cell. Here's a kind of horizontal gene exchange that can occur, or horizontal gene transfer that can occur in eukaryotes, where you have the uptake by a phagocytosis of various kinds of things. These could be other eukaryotic cells. They can be bacteria, they can be viruses, presumably free DNA. And then once this has been taken up, it ends up in a food vacuole inside of the cytoplasm, and these food vacuoles occasionally, in evolutionary terms, break open, releasing DNA into the cytoplasm. And this DNA, once it's in the cytoplasm, has the potential to find its way into the nucleus. I guess that's the nucleus right here. And once DNA is in the nucleus, it has some potential to integrate into the nuclear genome, the chromosome. And as a consequence, you can end up with movement from the materials that are being eaten by a phagocytic protist eukaryotic cell into the actual genome of these cells, into the nuclear chromosomes of these cells. And it's a way in which these organisms can basically build up their genetic variation. It's a way in which they can acquire new genes that can provide them with new functions. Of course, if these genes don't come from eukaryotes, then there's going to, the cell is going to have to inadvertently get these genes under their own eukaryotic control of gene expression. But these things happen by random reshuffling of the genome, and eventually it's possible for the genes that have inadvertently made their way into the nucleus to in fact turn into genes that are expressed by the nucleus and perhaps targeted elsewhere in the cell. So this is a means along with viruses by which foreign DNA can enter into eukaryotes in the absence of mating. Of course, endosymbiotic events is another means by which DNA can end up into eukaryotes. So what happens when you don't have sexual processes, when you don't have gene exchange, is you have instead a maintenance of clonality. So all microbes can reproduce asexually and generate clones and clonal lineages of themselves. Indeed, in natural populations of all microbial species examined, including viruses, bacteria, protozoa, algae, and fungi, evidence of clones and clonal lineages is abundant. So while microorganisms, in fact, can display various sexual processes, truly the dominant means by which reproduction occurs is in a manner that does not involve sex, and the processes by which DNA is introduced into these lineages are sufficiently rare that the organisms themselves tend to propagate as clones. Establishing clonality can also be important in determining the source of an epidemic disease, of an infectious disease. So let's say you have a bacterium. The bacterium has infected multiple patients. The question is there a problem in how you are handling these patients that is allowing some similar organism to infect them? Or isn't there indeed some bug, some organism that is passing around, say, a clinic that is simply quite effective at transmitting, as being transmitted to these patients? And how do you tell the difference between these two hypotheses? The answer is you determine the clonality of this pathogen between patients. If it's clonally the same organism, then you know you have a problem with the specific organism. And how do you determine clonality? Well, you can do various kinds of approaches, such as restriction digests of the genomes, these DNA fingerprinting, and this can give you a really quick and easy sense of how similar two organisms are. If they have equivalent restriction digests, then they're probably clones of each other. Of course, these days we've gotten to the point where sequencing is so inexpensive that if you really wanted to figure out definitively whether two organisms are clonally related, you just sequence the entire genomes of the two organisms, particularly if they're bacteria and the genomes are tiny. So, looking at bacterial sex, we have transduction, we have conjugation, we have transformation, we have a donor cell, we have a recipient cell, we have the transfer via phages. Is dependent upon this infectious agent, the bacteriophages. When you have transfer of genes that are associated with the plasmid, this too is dependent upon an infectious agent, the plasmid. Recall that we don't have recombination that occurs in the traditional sense when you have plasmid transfer. Certainly you don't have molecular recombination unless recombination between the plasmid and the chromosome of the recipient bacteria actually occur. This is this HFR, this high frequency of recombination strains, and these are probably rare. And then it's possible that the acquisition of DNA in the course of transformation is actually a means by which bacteria acquire DNA as food rather than necessarily something that the bacteria are doing in order to increase the likelihood of their recombination, their sexual association with some other organism. However, that's not necessarily proven, but in certain cases it might be that, in fact, transformation is kind of an inadvertent sexual process that is a consequence of the bacteria trying to accomplish something else, and this something else could be simply consuming DNA that they're taking up as food. So looking more closely at transformation, taking up naked DNA from the environment, the way this DNA usually comes in is as single-stranded pieces of DNA. And here we're seeing homologous recombination with a site on the chromosome that has high sequence similarity with the incoming DNA. Recombination, note that it's only one of the strands of the double helix that actually ends up being recombined, and therefore you only end up with this homologous recombination seen in one of the daughter cells of two. So this is a very low cost sexual process. The fact that it's homologous recombination means that it's probably not going to be disrupting the genome of the recipient cell all that much, and the fact that only a single progeny ends up being the progeny, the recombinant individual, and the other is not a recombinant individual, also means that the cost of going through sex like this is relatively low. So, in terms of transformation, there's probably not a huge cost to the organism for participating in this kind of gene exchange. On the other hand, this kind of gene exchange is particularly suited to homologous recombination rather than some kind of insertion of new genes into the organism, the recipient bacterium, because in fact, the genes are coming in as single stranded DNA rather than as double stranded DNA. So this is a competent cell. Competent means that it's capable of picking up DNA from the environment. It's competent for transformation. Here we have what can be described as a heteroduplex, basically DNA that's come from two different sources in the same double helix. So this is this gene transfer by competence. This is transformation. So natural transformation is the only mechanism that can potentially explain how bacteria acquire DNA from foreign species beyond the host range of mobile genetic elements of bacteriophages. So in this way, transformation is special in that what is taken up by a naturally competent bacterium could possibly be any kind of DNA. However, whether that DNA can actually be retained if it's not capable of homologously recombining with the host cell is an important question. Certainly, variations on what kind of DNA the bacterium can have can occur as a consequence of transformation and associated homologous recombination. But whether you can get dramatic changes in what kind of genes a bacterium holds via transformation, it seems to be somewhat unlikely. DNA transformation can potentially transmit gene-bearing fragments or even circular plasmids between very distantly related bacterial species. So DNA can come in, DNA can, if it can recombine and otherwise be retained within these bacteria, it can stay there. DNA can come from all sorts of sources, but there is some limitation in terms of its potential to be retained within the recipient bacterium. And there's also something called vesicle-associated transformation, where you actually have these vesicles that seem to bleb off from the plasma membrane of bacteria that seem to be able to contribute to an ability of bacteria to transmit genes to other bacteria. What exactly this, what role it plays in terms of the fitness of the donor bacterium is an open question, but this might be an additional means, transformation-like means by which bacteria can exchange genes. And so we return to this, where we have again bacteria, we have archaea, we have eukarya, we've got various means by which DNA can be exchanged within the different domains, and also some means by which DNA can be exchanged between the domains. In bacteria, it is transduction and transformation and conjugation, which are the primary means of transfer. Transduction involves viruses packaging bacterial DNA. Transformation is the taking up of naked DNA from the environment, and conjugation is the transmission of plasmids, plasmid-encoded transmission of plasmids between bacteria. And you also have this, you are what you eat in the eukaryotes, where during phagocytosis, DNA that happens to be taken up into vesicles potentially can make its way into the cytoplasm and therefore into the nucleus. And then you also have endosymbiosis acting predominantly in eukaryotes, which is another means by which DNA from foreign individuals can find its way into the cytoplasm and then potentially into the nucleus if indeed these endosymbiotes happen to lyse within the eukaryotic cells that they're inhabiting. Even without this transfer to the nucleus, the endosymbiote itself is transferring DNA into a new cell. Even if that DNA remains inside of the endosymbiote can contribute to the functioning of the eukaryotic cell that it inhabits, and it can contribute particularly by supplying novel functions that are encoded by its genes. So it's a kind of horizontal gene transfer. Remember that transduction is the means by which bacteria have DNA transferred between them as mediated by bacteriophages. And more traditionally, one considers generalized transduction versus specialized transduction. With generalized transduction, you have the inadvertent packaging of bacterial DNA in its entirety without any associated phage DNA. And in this case, you can transmit relatively large amounts of DNA. You can transmit whole plasmids from one bacterium to another. This is targeted in terms of what bacteria serve as the recipients by the host range of the phage that's doing the transducing, because the phage are only going to be able to absorb and download their DNA into a small subset of potential bacterial targets. Specialized transduction, by contrast, means that the DNA from the bacterium recombines into the genome of a phage. And when you have transfer occurring, it's not just the DNA of the bacterium that's being transferred, also DNA of the phage. You see specialized transduction associated particularly with phages that can display lysogenic cycles, because it's especially during the conversion from the lysogenic cycle to the lytic cycle that the incorporation of bacterial DNA occurs. There's a third possibility, so we've got three kinds of transduction that is described using the word morons. Morons means more DNA, and what it means is you have an incorporation of DNA. Perhaps it's bacterial DNA, perhaps it's DNA coming from other phages, but you have this incorporation via predominantly illegitimate recombination of a new section of DNA into a phage genome. And then when this phage genome moves from bacterium to bacterium, it's carrying this extra DNA along with it. So a moron is a phage or bacterial DNA that is incorporated into a phage's genome, presumably via illegitimate recombination. And these genes that are incorporated into these phages can include bacterial virulence factors, including bacterial exotoxin genes. So this can be an important means by which the virulence of a bacterium is modified, particularly if these morons are being carried by temperate phages that are able to establish lysogenic infections in which these potential bacterial virulence factor genes thereby essentially become one of the many genes that are found in a bacterial chromosome. Moron acquisition can be considered to be specialized transduction in the sense that these phages are carrying both viral and bacterial DNA, although this is not usually the way people think about morons. They think about it really as an additional means by which DNA can be transferred between bacteria as mediated by phages. There's also a fine line between what is a moron gene and what is a phage gene. In many cases, phages end up with new genes, and it's difficult to tell where those new genes came from and also what, if any, function they play in the phage life cycle. And then also, there's an argument that phages themselves may have originated via what is described as moron accretion. That is, the phage genome built up in terms of the number of genes present by acquiring one gene at a time via illegitimate recombination, such as from their bacterial host, but also potentially from other phages. So generalized transduction, also known as common transduction, this is movement of bacterial DNA or cellular DNA as mediated by the packaging within viral capsids. It's capable of transferring, in the case of bacterial DNA by phages, many tens of kilobases of DNA, including plasmid DNA. So these phages, 50 KB phages are not unusual, 50,000 bases. 100,000 KB phages are not that unusual. And so there's a lot of DNA that could be transferred in one fell swoop by a single bacteriophage via generalized transduction. And in addition to carrying individual genes, there's also the potential that phages can carry large chunks of DNA that is associated with that has become associated with itself for reasons specifically such that they could potentially be packaged in the course of generalized transduction and moved to a new bacterium. And this is the case with genomic islands, of which pathogenicity islands are the most familiar. So genomic islands, basically what you have is a series of genes that are associated into a single block of DNA. And these could be multiple metabolic pathways, including various kinds of virulence factors. And the result is that you have essentially associated gene functions that can be moved in one fell swoop in a relatively large chunk of DNA, such as can be mediated by bacteriophages. In addition to pathogenicity islands, there are symbiosis islands, various islands that contribute to certain metabolic processes, resistance islands to resisting various processes, and then also what could be described as fitness islands. Basically, what they have in common is that they are associated in, again, a single block that has the potential of being picked up by a phage and moved from one bacterium to another. So these genomic islands, in essence, are discrete DNA segments differing between closely related bacterial strains to which usually some past or present mobility is attributed. If we accept this definition, it will comprise an overarching family of elements with different functional life cycles, lifestyles. So it's not just pathogenicity that can be transferred, it's other types of strategies that can be acquired by bacteria, again, in one fell swoop by a generalized transduction event. It's just that the pathogenicity islands are the most studied because, of course, they're associated with pathogens, and most research funding goes towards understanding pathogenesis in this aspect of microbiology. So back to generalized transduction. So you've got a phage. It infects a cell. Its genome is translocated into the cytoplasm of the bacterium. The bacterium is then turned into a phage-making machine. The phages make their capsids or procapsids and other parts, and then they package their DNA. But in the course of packaging their DNA, they can inadvertently package the DNA associated with the host chromosome. And then when that DNA is transferred to a new host, there's some potential for homologous recombination, as they're showing here. Alternatively, there's potential for illegitimate recombination, where you have an insertion event where the DNA, such as the genomic island, becomes incorporated into the recipient bacterium. And indeed, these genomic islands carry genes that increase the potential for them, in fact, to be inserted into recipient bacteria. So these viral products produced, the host genome is fragmented. You have picking up of host DNA, typically at a relatively low rate, and then you have transfer. Here we have a plasmid, and a plasmid is a small, usually circular-shaped piece of DNA as found in bacteria. And here we have the conjugation step, which is mediated across these bridges that connect the cytoplasms together. It's very important, of course, for transfer resistance genes, such as antibiotic resistance genes. This plasmid transfer, actually, these conjugative plasmids are capable of, in fact, conjugating of transferring plasmids, not just within species, but also across species, and perhaps even across larger spans than that. So there's a great potential for transfer of DNA far and wide via conjugative plasmids. The conjugation event involves the sex pili. The sex pili snares the recipient bacterium, leads to formation of a mating bridge over which the plasmid DNA is passed. Here's a mating bridge right here. So basically the F plus bacterium that produces the pilus pulls in the F minus bacterium so that these mating bridges can be formed, and it's across the mating bridges that the DNA is passed. So here we have the pilus, the docking, the mating, the pulling together of the of the two cells to form these mating bridges across which the DNA from the plasmid is passed. Of course, the plasmid replicates itself in the process, so it creates a new plasmid in the recipient bacterium. And then the recipient bacterium is capable of producing an F pilus that then can continue the conjugation.